So we're going to be in the book of Genesis, starting in chapter 42 and verse 18, which is where we left off last week. And let's open up with a word of prayer. Father, I come before you. I pray for your blessing on this discussion. I pray you give me strength, clarity of mind, and clearness of speech. I pray you be glorified in all we do say and think. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. So, for those of you who haven't been here, or just as a brief review, after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot, or generations, headings. And so you have the prologue, which explains the origins of the world. And you have 5 sections that deal with the origins of the nations. And then you have 5 sections that deal with the origins of Israel. And those 5 sections are sort of this alternating between the chosen line and the non-chosen line. So you have the generations of Terah, which deals with Abraham, the generations of Ishmael, which deals with the descendants of Ishmael, the generations of Isaac, which focuses on Jacob, the generations of Esau, which deals with the descendants of Esau, and then you have the final section, which is the one to which we have arrived, and that is the generations of Jacob. And each of the 10 toledot deal not with the person who is named in the heading, but rather with the person or persons that are in some sense descended from the one who's named in the headings. And so as we get into this section about Jacob's family, so this final section is about Jacob's children. And so in the first chapter, chapter 37, we find division in the family. So all the family is together, but they're very divided, and they hate one another, and they sell Joseph into slavery. So as we try to get the big picture of the story of Jacob and his children, we have to realize it's not just the story of Joseph. Joseph, of course, is the central figure, but it's a story about the nation, how Israel becomes a nation, about Jacob's children as a whole. And so you have a divided family in 37, and then in 38, you have the story of Judah apart from his family. So Judah is among the pagans in the land of Canaan. Judah marries a pagan woman. He has 2 children. He has 2 sons that survive. There's a whole story about that, and we've gone over that on past occasions. Then in 39 through 41, so you have Judah apart from his brothers. 39 through 41, you have Joseph apart from his brothers. And so you have in Potiphar's house, he's in prison, and then he rises to be over Pharaoh's house. So you have these 3 episodes of Joseph apart from his brothers. Then you have the next overall section, and that is 3 journeys down to Egypt. So you have the coming back together of the family. So you have initially the families together, but there's this tension. Then you have the family is scattered. Then you have 3 episodes of the family coming back together, and then you have the family unified and preparing to multiply at the end of the book of Genesis in the final section. So these 3 journeys down to Egypt, you have the first journey by the brothers that takes place in chapter 42. You have the second journey, which includes Benjamin, and that takes place in 43 through 45. And you have the third journey in chapters 46 through 47, which includes the whole family. And then the final section, you have the passing of the generations in 48 through 50. Chapter 42, which we got part of the way through last week, and Lord willing, finish tonight, as well as possibly getting through 43 if we move very quickly, relates the first of these 3 journeys to Egypt. The second journey, like the first, I mentioned this word, kind of a complicated word. It's structured palistrophically, or you could say that it's a ring composition. And I wish I thought to maybe get a board up here so I could show you. But here's basically what a ring composition looks like. You have subject A, and you have subject A. Then you have B and B. You have C and C. And then you have something in the center. And of course, you can have varying different levels that way, but you get the idea that you end where you started. And then when you get closer to the middle, you're talking about the same thing. Closer to the middle, you're talking about the same thing. And there'll be something in the center of that. And these 2 accounts, so the first journey by the brothers, and then the second journey by the brothers are structured almost exactly the same. So you have Jacob's sons sent to Egypt at the beginning of both accounts. And then you have their arrival in Egypt described in chapter 42 and in chapter 43. In chapter 42, you have their first audience with Joseph. And in chapter 43, you have a first audience with Joseph. And then in the account of chapter 42, you have a very brief description of the fact that they're imprisoned. In chapter 44, so remember that the second journey takes over three chapters. So in the second journey, in chapter moving into chapter 44, you have a more lengthy description of how they're all arrested and they're taken back. So they're taken into custody, they're taken into captivity over the silver cup. And then you have a second audience with Joseph in chapter 42 and in chapter 44. And going into chapter 45, then you have a departure from Egypt in both cases, and you have a report back to Jacob in both cases. So both of these two journeys begin with a conversation with Jacob. They go to Egypt. They meet with Joseph. They end up in prison. They meet with Joseph again. They go home, and they report to their father. And then on the third episode, it turns out very differently. So you have a different structure for that. But there's one interesting thing. You have these things that are clearly told in parallel, but one of them is much longer than the other. So based on what we just talked about, what are two episodes that are parallel, one of which is much longer than the other, the second of which is much longer than the other? Does anyone have any ideas? Yeah, so this journey to Egypt is the one we're talking about. What's something else that's like that in this immediate context? And let's go ahead and raise our hands when we're answering questions so we can look at the whole room and call on people. Does anyone have any idea? So remember yes, in the back. Gavin.
The story of Judah and the story of Joseph.
Yes, you got it. That there's so many overlaps between Judah apart from his brothers and Joseph apart from his brothers, but the story of Joseph apart from his brothers is much, much longer than the story of Judah apart from his brothers. And so you have this where you have two very parallel stories, and one of them will be very significantly expanded. So in the one case, the first journey takes one chapter, the second journey takes no less than three chapters. And so this is just one of the things that you'll see going on, that sometimes the way in which it's expanded causes you to miss the parallels where the stories are structured exactly the same. And if you wonder why we're talking about all of this, you could describe the same events and structure the way the story is told very differently. So the fact that these two stories are told in like perfect parallel is significant. This is something that you find very frequently in the story of David. In the story of David, if we ever get to the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, a few decades from now, if we're all still alive, then we'll find that in the story of David, events are told out of chronological order in order to put the story in a particular pattern that contrasts David's career with that of Saul. And so this idea of the patterning of the story is something to pay very careful attention to as you read the Old Testament, because it's often telling stories where the structure of the story parallels that of another story is often more significant than strict chronological order. And so that's something to keep aware of. So let's see, where were we? All right, so there are seven scenes in each of these stories. And so we finished chapter 41, Joseph's rise to power. And then we got to the first half of chapter 42, Joseph's brothers went down to Egypt, and the first interview with Joseph, and their brief imprisonment. And now we're about to talk about the second interview with Joseph, beginning in 42 and 18. But before we do that, are there any questions or comments about what we've covered up to this point?
The structure you're talking about, the ring structure, is that also called a chiastic?
Yes, it is.
And if I remember correctly, chiastic structure often will that AA, BB, CC, and then the middle. The middle is actually the apex, right?
Like yes, typically.
Okay.
It can often be the case. That's true. It probably depends on how you talk to, how much emphasis is placed on that center point. It depends on the story. So in this case, I think that is significant because the center in both cases is the brothers in custody. And you remember we talked about a few weeks ago how a story will be told, it'll be retold, and you'll expect the same thing to happen, but something different happens. And so what's different about the next story is that they're not further imprisoned. So they get treated badly, then they get treated worse, and then they get treated completely different. And so that would be significant. It depends on, there are some people who want to see a chiasm for like every biblical book having a chiastic structure. I'm more persuaded of like a chapter being arranged chiastically. Some books are, but I think some people see chiasms everywhere. I see them many places. They're obviously in many places. Once they get exceedingly complicated, then it gets to be a little bit more doubtful, you know. But there often is an emphasis on the apex for sure. And you see this not just in big chapters, but even in the Psalms, in particular verses. So you see this, it's a pattern you find in the Psalms. So you find it really, it's very common in oral cultures where material is being memorized because it helps, by having the end like the beginning, it helps you have that sense of closure that helps you to know you've remembered the whole thing. It's something that I often do when I'm preaching as well, circle back to the beginning at the end because it gives you a sense of closure that we finished what we started out to talk about. And it's just a basic sort of thing that is often done in speaking. Any other questions, comments? That was very helpful. Anything else? All right, let's dig into the text. 42:18. Pardon me. And Joseph said unto them the third day, "This do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses." And of course, that corn, as we talked about before, is simply grain, probably wheat. "But bring your youngest brother unto me, so that shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die." And they did so. And they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us." And Reuben answered them, saying, "Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear? Therefore, behold, also his blood is required." And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. And he turned himself about from them and wept, and returned to them again, and communed with them, and took from them Simeon, and bound him before their eyes. So we have Joseph's first plan. He's going to initially, he says, "I'm going to imprison all of you and send one of you to go back and bring the youngest brother." Now we find that Joseph has a second plan. Who else had two plans for how to deal with their brother? His brothers did. Yep, his brothers did. Initially, they were going to kill him, and then they decided to sell him. So there's a number of really eerie parallels between what's taking place with Joseph's brothers and what took place with Joseph, and those, of course, are likely intentional. But we are left wondering, was this Joseph's plan from the beginning? Was he originally just trying to scare them and he knew all along he was just going to keep one of them? Or was he making this up as he went along? And when you think about it, the accusation of being spies and "I'll know you're not spies because you bring your youngest brother" is pretty ad hoc. It's pretty like making it, it doesn't really make sense. I mean, it's like if they really were spies, it wouldn't have been a problem to produce an additional person and say, "This is our younger brother." It seems like maybe Joseph is sort of coming up with this as he goes along, because some of the things he says are a bit weird. But they are portrayed throughout the story as being total klutzes, and they just really miss every cue, and they're very confused by what's taking place. And of course, I mean, if you had like the governor of the land staring down at you and leaning into you, you would probably miss a few cues as well. Yeah, so perhaps it's understandable. But it is, you know, Joseph's doing some sort of, he's behaving strangely. And it's perhaps significant that, as one commentator pointed out, Joseph's two plans to deal with his brothers parallel his brothers' two plans to deal with him. But it's important to recognize, up to this point in the story, we don't know, if we're reading this for the first time, we don't know what Joseph intends. We don't know. Has Joseph become bitter? And we haven't seen that yet. And he's going to really wreak this terrible vengeance on his brothers. This is part of the tension. If you read the story as if you're reading it for the first time, you have this question. What's Joseph's motive here? What's he really doing? Verse 19, if ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. In detaining just one of your one of his brothers, so this is a quote from a commentator, and sending the others back without him to Jacob, Joseph is not simply devising a punishment to fit the crime, but making them relive their actions some 20 years earlier. And the brothers realize the parallels and lose their tempers discussing the affairs. And so Joseph, by leaving one of the brethren in prison while the others go back home to their father, he is deliberately, at this point, deliberately bringing to mind what they had done years before. So it's no wonder that they began to think of that particular situation. That has got to be intentional on Joseph's part. And so they begin to argue and bewail what they had done. In verse 21, the first part, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and we would not hear. You find in Proverbs 21:13, whoso stoppeth his ears at the cry of the poor, he also shall cry himself, but shall not be heard. This is the first that we're hearing of Joseph's cries. It doesn't tell us about that in Genesis 37 when it talks about him being sold into slavery. And if you allow bitterness to fester in your heart, you will find yourself capable of doing things that you once would have thought impossible. And you think about Joseph's brothers. When they first began to be bitter at their little brother, I really doubt they would think of themselves as the sort of people that would let their teenage brother scream and cry and starve in a pit while they ate a meal and pay no heed whatsoever. But they became bitter until they wouldn't even speak to him. And the more they became bitter and the more they focused on that, they got to the point where he could utter these heartrending cries and they couldn't care less. And the question of application that this leads to is, what could be some areas in our own lives in which we could allow bitterness to fester and be hardening our hearts right now? Because all of us have areas in which our hearts are being hardened, where we will find ourselves being able to do and think and say things that we once would have thought were impossible. So what could be some areas in our time, in our lives? Doesn't have to be specific, the specific thing you're growing bitter about. That might be better in private. But what could be some ways in which this could show up in our lives? Rick?
There's a lot of them, but just a couple would be like, you need money for something, so you kind of slowly but surely allow yourself to excuse the misuse of money, like maybe at your place of employment or with a family member or whatever. Or, you know, sometimes in a relationship, you're not getting the attention you think you deserve or whatever, so you become bitter against your spouse or your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever, and then you excuse, giving attention to someone else. There's lots of ways, and it's like you said, the end of the result is horrible.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Brother TJ?
Going along, Rick, same thing. You can loan money to somebody, and then you're out there seeing them spend all this money, and they haven't paid you back yet, and it's not a whole lot or something. They can get you bitter.
Yeah, that's true.
That's why you got to really, you got to fight that old man's every day. Every day you got to get right back.
Yeah, absolutely. Grace? Yeah. Absolutely. That's true. Anyone else? Rachel.
I think that bitterness from a past experience can, you can try to not be bitter, but you have to still and you try to cover that up for yourself long that you are then finding yourself applying that past to people around you and then screw up.
Yeah, I think that can be. I think we can very often find ourselves bitter about things and being unwilling to admit, well, I know I'm bothered about it, but I'm not really bitter about it until the fruits of bitterness start to manifest themselves. And then we realize I've got a lot of things to deal with, and it's going to take me as long to deal with it as it took me to get to the spot that I'm at. Sherry?
Sometimes you're in a position of having to care for elderly parents for a long period of time or family members, and they have, especially if you've had ones that have had Alzheimer's, and it takes years, you know, where you're involved with that, you know, and I think sometimes that can create a bitterness with inside. You feel trapped.
Yeah.
And you become bitter against the situation that, you know, you should be doing with love, but it really bugs you.
And I think it's really important to, you know, that hour of conversation with a friend, that not necessarily that you have an hour of conversation with a particular friend every week, but that principle of having open communication with people where you can be honest about what you're feeling, but they don't validate everything that you're feeling. There's this line between being able to share what's bothering you and having someone be understanding and yet being willing to point you in the right direction and someone who validates every bad emotion that you have. You don't need to share what you're struggling with someone who will encourage you to think that you're doing fine. If you're struggling, you need to share with someone who loves you enough to be sympathetic and who also loves you enough to say, you need to change your perspective because if you keep going down this path, you're going to end in a bad place. So it's not just that you have open communication, but it's who you choose to have open communication with, because that makes a tremendous amount of difference. If you have friends that validate your every negative emotion, you need to get some new friends. Not that you need to stop being friends with them, but you need to stop looking to them for counsel. And that's something in marriage, you need to support your spouse, but if you cheer your spouse on, particularly wives with husbands, if everything your husband does is the best ever, that is actually not very healthy, however much I may want my wife to tell me that everything I'm frustrated about is valid. The reality is there are times when I'm frustrated by things where I'm the problem and she needs to tell me that. And that's love to tell me that, and I'm thankful that she does. But that's something even young men, as you're looking for a spouse, you need to look for someone who will call you out in a loving and respectful way when your behavior and attitude needs to change. This is a good discussion. What are some other ways this could show up?
I think being motivated by mistreatment to be found like your life goal to be that I'll never be like them, and you don't realize that you start to imitate them.
Yeah. That's true. Yes?
Jealousy.
That's really what happened with Joseph's brothers, that they became very jealous of what was going on, and that was what drove their bitterness. Amy?
I was actually going to say a similar thing that Sherry said, but in the context of motherhood or parenting in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you going to say something else, sir? Okay, Brother Tanaka.
Well, I think we've seen it in Joseph and Jacob and Esau is when parents have favoritism, and that often makes the ones less favored feel unloved or unwanted in that. So trying to protect that.
Yeah, that's in.
Sometimes when you think there are friendships where one person has a strength that you don't have, and that kind of does take you forward. It's that person. Sometimes you're like, how can I so easy for that?
Yeah. And you could become bitter against the Lord that he didn't give you that strength or that opportunity. I know that's something, you know, something that's happened to me on a number of occasions where I've felt frustrated, like, why does that person have this thing that I want to do so bad? And it's just easy for them. They've had every opportunity. And then so often you find out that the thing that you have is what they want. And often God shapes our souls not only by what he gives us, but what he withholds from us. And Sarah?
Like not giving someone the benefit of the doubt. Mm. Or, you know, like maybe you misunderstand someone or did something personal and it was of no big deal to him, a finding the situation. And then
yeah.
Next thing you know, you've been so bitter and worked up in your mind that you like hate the person and it's started over something stupid.
Yeah, that happens all the time. And by God's grace, I think our heart in the congregation needs to be to love one another enough to call each other out in love when it's necessary, but also to love one another enough to overlook things in love when it's possible. And so if you can overlook something, then do it. If you're still worrying about it, then in love, go and approach someone, but don't allow your relationship to be destroyed by something that could be a simple misunderstanding. Brother TJ?
Sorry, one more. So being a supervisor for 17 years and actually somebody who cares about his people, because I don't have a penetration, right, of people, you can be an understanding supervisor to the point where it can be difficult not to be angry with someone after years of listening to the same problems and doing everything you can to help them, and yet you're like, you know, why are you even doing this? You're stressing me out too. And the sad part about that is it can be, like for pastors even, I mean, you folks hear a lot of things every day, all day long. And it can be hard, I think, for some people to understand that and still keep that sense of caring. You got 300 people with 300 issues. Maybe number 250 doesn't think you're as caring as number 100 did. In reality, it's not the case.
That can certainly be a challenge when you can become so frustrated with people bringing the same issue that sometimes you don't, maybe, are tempted not to take the time to actually understand what's causing the issue. That is, you put everybody in a box. I've got this answer for this, this answer for this, and that can be a temptation.
That's your job.
Yeah, to just sort of, I've got all the automated answers and I'm just going to fire them off, but taking the time to listen to people is certainly, there's a temptation to not do that, and that's something that is important to do. Janine?
Just going back to Sarah's comment and what you said after that, is it that point where you're already thinking about worrying about what that person just said to you against your brother and you're commanded to go to them and get that straightened out? I would much rather somebody come up to me and say, I didn't like the way you said I love you. Can you explain what you mean by that? Then for them to go and say, well, I just think you just said it just to say it.
Yeah.
I would much rather have that clarification between me and a brother or me and a sister, knowing exactly what you mean, even in love if I'm being reprimanded.
It's something where
and worry or even go that route.
We're called to love one another enough to risk making ourselves look foolish. If it's big enough to break your relationship, it's big enough to go to them, even if it makes you look bad. That's the real reason why we often don't confront people. It's because we have a sneaking suspicion that the problem might be us, and we're afraid to validate that by voicing it in the open and having them be the potential to say, what were you thinking I said? That doesn't make any sense. But as long as we keep it inside and have this feedback loop where we only talk to ourselves or only to other people who will always validate everything that we say, then we can't be confronted for how we may have responded wrongly. And that's what destroys unity. April.
I think sometimes unrealistic expectations of other people and that they can't deliver these expectations you have, so that drives bitterness.
Yeah, that's That's true, and sometimes even realistic expectations of other people that they refuse to meet, and we can become so frustrated about the way that they're messing up our lives, but it's basically anything. It doesn't, you know, in the end, it doesn't necessarily even, it does matter, but it can start, as we've heard from all of these testimonies, in so many different ways. The question is, how long are you going to let it continue? Because if you let it continue, it can take you to a place that you never thought you'd go. This can happen on a personal level, obviously, all the different ways we talked about. But I think it's important to recognize the ways that this can take place on a national level in the field of politics and public discourse, that this is what politicians do to get elected. They pick a particular group and they begin to blame all the problems of the nation on that group of people. And the news media that's pushing their views validates everything that they say, and everything you hear about this particular group, if you listen to your tribe, is going to be that they're bad, and someone else listens to a different tribe, and they hear that the problem is this other group. And so one group says the billionaires are the problem, and another group says, well, the immigrants or the illegal immigrants are the source of all of our ills, and someone else says the bankers are the problem, and someone else says this or that or whatever group is the source of all of our ills. And we need to recognize where that kind of rhetoric leaves. I was doing some reading as I was reading for the illustration for this morning. I was reviewing a book I'd read a number of years ago about the rise to power in Nazi Germany. And we need to recognize that the things that were said about the Jews initially, or any of the other groups that were selected for extermination, they started with the same kind of rhetoric that we hear. Whatever your news media source is, you're hearing the kind of rhetoric that, left unchecked, leads to exterminating the group against which people's bitterness has been enraged. And even as Hitler was rising to power, in fact, the year that he rose to power, there were newspaper columns saying the German people would never be so barbaric as to actually persecute the Jews. Extermination wasn't even on the table. Just, there would never be governmental persecution. That would never happen. But people's bitterness was being raised as, they're the ones who caused us to lose the first war. They're the ones who caused us to be enslaved to the bankers. They're the source of the problem. And as people allowed themselves to become bitter about that, eventually they stood by and watched as they were killed. And don't think that can't happen in our country, because that root of bitterness, that process can take place in any of our own hearts at a personal level, but also as a people. And so when you hear someone who's trying to blame all the problems of the nation on a particular group, be very, very careful and don't buy into that, because it's a cheap trick that is used and has always been used since the beginning of politics and is always destructive. Any last comments before we move on? That's a good discussion. So where were we? Got a bit far afield from Genesis, but it's good to talk through these things. And so now we come to the second part of verse 21. Therefore is this distress come upon us. Be not deceived, Paul writes in Galatians. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. In Matthew 7:2, we find this: for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, with what measure you measure, it will be measured to you. And I think that's something we also, their bitterness had caused them to do something terrible, and they recognized they reaped what they sowed. You find in the book of Job, if you sow the wind, you're going to reap the whirlwind. And many people have found that to be the case. And then we find Reuben is answering them, and he's saying, look, I told you so. So this is quite possibly, it's unlikely that Joseph is overhearing all of their conversation. He's down in the bottom of an empty cistern, so he probably doesn't have really great acoustics down there. And this is probably the first that Joseph is hearing of Reuben's intervention on his behalf. He's been in Egypt. He doesn't know that Reuben tried to save his life. And so that's why, most likely, Joseph is overcome by emotion. He's learning things about what took place among his brothers that he may have never known before. And so he turns himself about from them in verse 24 and he weeps. And up to this point, Joseph's actions have been ambiguous at best. So we don't know. Is Joseph out to get revenge? Maybe. Is he testing his brothers? Is he just kind of doing a meltdown? We don't necessarily know what's taking place. But when Joseph weeps at what he hears, that's giving us a clue. Whatever's about to take place, there's more going on than the brothers realize. And we don't know yet why he's weeping, but we know he's overcome by emotion. So he's not hard-heartedly out to get them, whatever the next few chapters are going to look like. And then in verse 24, he takes from them Simeon. Why does he take Simeon? Who is Simeon? He's not the eldest.
Is he the youngest that's with him?
No. So who's Simeon's mother?
Leah.
So Reuben is the firstborn. Who's the secondborn? Simeon. So the first four children that Leah has are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And those four children are born to Leah before any children are born to Rachel and before Rachel gives her handmaiden, Bilhah, to Jacob. So these are Jacob's four oldest children. Now, Joseph has just learned that Reuben tried to spare his life. And so he takes the next oldest and imprisons him. And also, Simeon and Levi, what were they known for? They were known for killing and violence. And so it is not at all... So right before they sell Joseph into slavery, they wiped out a city. So they were violent men. And so it's not at all unlikely that Simeon had been the ringleader in imprisoning Joseph. And so Simeon is imprisoned. And the brothers head home. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn or grain and to restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way. And thus did he unto them. And they laded their asses or their donkeys with the corn or the grain and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass or donkey provender in the inn, he espied his money. For behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God hath done unto us? In verse 25, as we find that the money was restored to their sacks, Joseph was testing his brothers to see if they valued money as much as they did before. Remember, what did they sell Joseph for?
30 pieces.
Silver. And so he's questioning them, would they hang on to the cash and abandon Simeon? The last time the word here translated as money occurred was in 37:28. And though it differs in translation, it's the same in Hebrew. So the word that you have as money here is the same word for silver. So coinage didn't exist until several hundred years after this. So you would have pieces of silver that you would weigh out. And so in the Old Testament, they don't have coinage until maybe the very end, maybe in some of the prophets, but in the Pentateuch, coinage hasn't been invented yet. And so they would just have silver that you'd weigh at the merchants. That's why it talks about balances, because you'd have to weigh how much silver you actually have. And so the last time, so if you're reading this text the way Moses wrote it, you're seeing they sold Joseph for silver. Joseph put silver in their sacks to see how they respond. They're passed by Midianite's merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph unto Egypt. There's actually been some interesting research done. It's really hard to be certain because there's just so many variables about the average price of slaves, and depending on how you take the, so it's hardly like this slam dunk argument, but there's this overall trajectory in the ancient Near East on the price of able-bodied slaves over the course of a few thousand years, and it just so happens that the price that's paid for Joseph fits very well on that trajectory of the value of slaves in different, sort of century chunks, because it's something that was frequently traded, and one of the things that we've dug up a lot of is an awful lot of receipts. And so you can trace these sorts of things. It's a lot of work, but it fits on the trajectory there. Verse 27, as one of them opened his sack, one of them opens his sack and he finds his silver. So you find in chapter 23 that they repeat this, story. So in chapter 43, they repeat the story to Joseph's servant. And there they say, and it came to pass when we came to the inn that we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, and we have brought it again in our hand. And so that raises the question. So in 42, it's described as just one person opening his sack and finding the money. So then they all find it when they go home to Jacob and, oh, we found all this money. So there's this ambiguity because they actually are going to mislead their father on several different points. So it may be that actually they're telling Joseph's servant the truth and they all open their sacks, and the text just describes the first of those openings and they all proceeded to open their sacks, and then later they stage this surprise thing for their father because they mislead him about almost everything that takes place in Egypt when we get to their version of events. So it's possible they're telling Joseph's servant the truth, and actually they all open their sacks at this point. And the text just describes the first one. It's also possible that they really did just open one, and when they're describing the event to Joseph's servant, they're sort of leaving out the detail of their father and just sort of telescoping everything together to not get into those weeds. So it's sort of left ambiguous whether they're being fully truthful in 43 or not. We don't know for sure. We do know at the end of 42, the section we're about to get into, they leave, their truthfulness leaves a lot to be desired. So it's a couple possibilities of how this would have looked. And it's really hard to be certain. Any questions about this section before we move on? Okay. 45:29. And they came unto Jacob their father unto the land of Canaan at 42:29, and told him all that had befell unto them, saying, the man who is the Lord of the land spake roughly unto us and took us for spies of the country. And we said unto him, we are true men, we are no spies. We be 12 brethren, sons of our father. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the country, said unto us, hereby shall I know that ye are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me, and take food for the famine of your households, and be gone. And bring your youngest brother unto me, then shall I know that ye are no spies, but that ye are true men. So will I deliver you your brother, and ye shall traffic in the land. And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob their father said unto them, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and he will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in the which ye go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. So verse 29, they are claiming to tell their father everything that happened to them in Egypt. But as we shall see, they've left some rather crucial bits of information out and added some things in that don't seem to have taken place. This is very interesting. Whenever you have a story that is told more than once, you pay attention to the subtle differences between those stories because they're often there and they're often indications of the way in which people are manipulating the story for their own benefit. So 42:32, I mentioned this last week. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. When they were talking to Joseph, they mentioned the youngest is with the brother, our father in the land of Canaan, and one is not. So the order has been reversed because they're leaving the most sensitive bit of information to last. And this by itself wouldn't be that significant, except that we see this over and over again in Genesis, that the most painful bit of information is left for last, and they've reversed the order so that they're mentioning to their father Benjamin last of all, because they're hesitant to talk about Benjamin to their dad because they know he's going to be reluctant to send him. That's trivial by itself, but it's one element among many. So then they say in verse 33, leave one of your brethren here with me. What have they completely skipped over? They've completely skipped over the 3 days they spent in prison and Joseph's first plan of imprisoning all of them and sending one back. So what else has changed here? They say, leave one of your brethren here with me. What else has been skipped over? That he's tied up and put in prison. They haven't mentioned that Simeon's in prison and bound. Earlier in the chapter, it says explicitly, he took Simeon from them and bound him in front of them. And he's putting the handcuffs on and doing the march of shame in front of them. They leave that out and they make it sound, leave one of your brothers here in my house and go get your younger brother. That's the way they're describing it. Totally different words are being used.
They also makes it sound like they had the choice instead of yet the choice.
Yes. Yep. What's something else they omit? What did Joseph say that he would do to them if they didn't bring their younger brother? They were dead. How Joseph planned on executing this, we don't know. But Canaan was actually you'd have to know the exact point of time of the story, which is sometimes hard to predict. But for most of this time, Canaan was more or less under the overlordship of Egypt. And so Joseph's threat to execute them was not, just because they were in Canaan, they weren't necessarily safe from Joseph. And he said, I'm going to kill you if you don't bring your youngest brother. They left that bit out. Then the most fascinating thing to me is verse 34, and ye shall traffic in the land. Joseph didn't say anything about this. This traffic doesn't mean they're going to get stuck in a traffic jam, but it means they're going to have the liberty to trade in the land. And this is the same Hebrew word that the Shechemites used in 34 as a bait to get Jacob to ignore Shechem's rape of Dinah. And ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein. So Shechem's bait to get Jacob to ignore Shechem's father's bait to get Jacob to ignore what Shechem had done to Dinah was that if you forget that all of this happened, you can trade in the land, Jacob. And it worked. Jacob was willing to completely overlook what they had done to his daughter because of this bait that they had thrown down. So we find the brothers inventing, it's not a coincidence, that they're inventing this same offer that we don't find earlier in the story and throwing it in, perhaps with the thought, if it worked once and made him forget about one of his children, maybe it will work again. But in this case, it doesn't. And they also don't mention the money in the sack. So regardless of whether they had all opened it or only one of them had opened it, they don't mention it at all. And they pretend to be completely shocked when they find the money. So it may be they were genuinely surprised to find the money in all 11 of their sacks, or it may be they were aware that it was in all 11 of their sacks and they're just pretending to be surprised at this point. But in any case, they knew about the money and they didn't tell their father. And this is something that's so fascinating to me. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. This is something one writer said that really, I think, has a profound insight into what's taking place here. Jacob's outburst, I would argue, implies that his fear differs from their uneasy sense of mystery. It is less obscure and more terrible. Two strange disclosures have been sprung on him in quick succession. Simeon's disappearance and the money's reappearance. Jacob refuses to accept them as coincidences. A tight causal explanation, clearing up one mystery in terms of another, suggests itself to him. The brothers have sold Simeon into slavery and are now pretending to be dismayed only to cover their tracks and lay the ground for another coup. So the last time a son disappeared, some silver appeared. And he didn't make any connections. There's no sense he had a suspicion that Joseph died from anything but an accident. But now for a second time, a son is disappearing and silver is reappearing. And so that makes sense of why Jacob explodes in the next verse. And Jacob, their father, said unto them, "Me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me." But that sounds maybe sort of just like a strong reaction, but the way the Hebrew is structured, it's an explosion. It could be translated this way to carry the emotion of the way that it's being written. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "I'm the one you are making childless. No Joseph, no Simeon, and Benjamin you want to take? Against me are all these things." That's the nuance of what's taking place. As one commentator put it, the sense is, it is I who suffer. It's my sons who disappear. So he's pitting himself against them and saying, "You're stealing my children from me." He's not putting it fully into words, but the intensity of the emotion and the crazy response of Reuben only makes sense in the light of a mutually shared, of him being suspicious that they've done something with Simeon and them being aware of that suspicion and not being able to deny it completely, because after all, they had sold Joseph for silver. And they couldn't. Their consciences had already been pricked. They couldn't just boldfacedly say, "We've never done anything against your children." And that's why Reuben makes his ridiculous proposal. And Reuben said unto his father, saying, "Slay my two sons. Kill your grandchildren." Really, Reuben? That's going to solve a lot, won't it? But the extravagance of Reuben's response, as the same writer that I quoted earlier put it, makes sense as a desperate response to an accusation that admits of no straightforward denial, not just because it is left unspoken, but mainly because it happens to be half true. And Reuben passes off the scene and plays no part in future leadership. So this is Reuben's swan song. Reuben really appears as a pretty pathetic character from day one, but in chapter 35, 22, it's important to remember why Reuben is so desperate to reassert his leadership, despite his inability to maintain it. In 35, 22, "And it came to pass, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah his father's concubine, and Israel heard it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. And so what happened was, after 34 and the debacle with the Shechemites, where Jacob's leadership appeared to be faltering, then Reuben went and slept with one of his father's wives. And given the age, it probably wasn't something that was driven by this extreme lust. It most likely was a bid to usurp his father's authority. Because if you remember, when Absalom takes over David's throne, he sleeps with his father's concubines. It's a claim to, in the ancient Near East, this was a recognized claim to authority. And this is what Reuben is trying to do. It doesn't work. And that's why, potentially, he's so desperate to save his father's favorite son, because he's trying to maintain his status as the firstborn. But ultimately, he's unsuccessful at that, and his pleas and tries become more and more frantic. And finally, he suggests to his father that he kill his grandsons if he doesn't bring Benjamin back. And that's the last we hear of Reuben. And then that clears the way for Judah, who's the fourth son down, to rise to ascendancy. And we're going to see that as we get into the next chapter. Last verse, 42:38. Jacob says, "My son shall not go down with you." Does that remind you of anything earlier in the story? I know last verse. We're almost done. Yes?
Jacob had said to Joseph, "Go down to your brothers."
Yes, but there's something that takes place at the end of that story. Well, we are out of time, so I'll just have to tell you all. 37:32. "They sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, 'This have we found. Know now whether it be thy sons, not our brothers, thy sons' coat or not.'" They had distanced themselves from the sons of Rachel, and now Jacob is distancing them from Rachel's sons. my son won't go down with you. So he's perpetuating the division that they had started. And we are now out of time, and we did not even start Genesis 43. But next week, Brother Sam Wood will be speaking, and then we'll pick up, Lord willing, with Genesis the week after that.